always expect something good on your lunch hour, connecting faith with life.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Joe Rathmanner. Great to have you here on this Friday afternoon. And, you know, one of the questions that I often get from people who are reading through their Bibles for the first time is, why is there so much violence in the Old Testament? Have you ever thought that, Ryan?
Yeah, it's definitely rampant.
Yes. Or I hear comments like, well, I really like the God of the New Testament.
Yes.
I don't really like that God of the Old Testament.
Right. Or there's some confusion, right?
Right.
At how the two intersect.
Absolutely. Questions I get are, well, God's supposed to be about peace, and there's not a lot of peace. I get things like that. Or how can a good God have commanded all of this warfare?
Things yeah, like and that. even a character like David, who's one of the most warlike in the history of the Bible, is a man after God's own heart.
Absolutely. So there is some confusion there. And one of the persons in my life who just enlightened me on all of these things is a very good friend of mine, Dr. Boyd Sievers. He was a professor of mine when I was in grad school. And so whenever I have an Old Testament question, I fired away at him and thought, why not just have him on the show?
Yeah.
Yes. So we are going to do that today. So let me introduce you to him and we will get started. Dr. Boyd Sievers is a professor of Old Testament studies at the University of Northwestern, St. Paul. He's an expert on ancient warfare and has participated in numerous archaeological excavations in Israel. He actually lived in Israel for 8 years, during which time he was a visiting professor at Jerusalem University College. He's written numerous articles for the Baker Illustrated Bible Dictionary and was the author of Joshua and Daniel in the book What the Old Testament Authors Really Cared About. He also wrote a book called Hidden in Plain Sight, Finding Wisdom and Meaning in the Parts of the Bible That Most People Skip. I love that title. And I use some of those excerpts in my own classes as well. Welcome, Dr. Sievers.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to have you here. So do you hear comments like that, those kind of questions that Ryan and I were just lamenting?
Of course. People often stumble over those things when they're going through the Bible.
Yes. In fact, I think I asked some of those questions probably during our class together, because you do kind of wonder when you first start reading, what in the world is all of the violence about? So what kind of answer do you give people?
Well, I say that the Bible is a record of God dealing with his people. And in the Old Testament, you have God dealing with the people for, you can say, 2,000 years. And any people over 2,000 years are going to have a lot of conflict and have a lot of wars. Our nation is, less than 250 years old. And how many wars have we been in? Lots.
Lots.
And we're on the verge of maybe getting back into another one. It's just unavoidable in our sinful, fallen world. And that was no less the case in the time of the Old Testament, perhaps even more so, given the limited resources over there. So the Israelites were involved in a lot of warfare. And since God was helping his people live out their lives in their world, he helps them through that and interacts with them in that way. So there's a lot of warfare.
So those things were occurring at that time. And if God is going to speak to people at the time, then he's going to be speaking to them within warfare, correct?
Yes, because that's just a big part of their world. I think as Americans, we're a little less familiar with that because we haven't had a draft since the Vietnam War or something like that. So, and we're so far removed from places of warfare that I think we're a little isolated from that, whereas most of the world would not be. And in Israel, that's certainly not the case. In this book that I just wrote, on Old Testament warfare, I start out with a story from the general manager of the company I worked for in Israel, where he was interviewing me when I first began to work at the company, and he asked if I'd been in the military, because everybody in Israel has been in the military, or almost everybody's been in the military. And he said, have you ever been in the military? No. And then he said, I can't imagine life without the army. Mm-hmm. So in modern Israel, that's the case. And I think in ancient Israel, that was the case. Or in ancient Philistia or Egypt or Babylon or any of those places, they just fought a lot. And so that was just more a part of life for them than it is for us.
Hmm. So the book that he has written is called Warfare in the Old Testament, The Organization, Weapons, and Tactics of Ancient Near Eastern Armies. And so why does the Old Testament contain so many battles and warfare? And then in the New Testament, we don't hear a lot about that.
Well, in the New Testament, you are not so much following the track of one nation so they don't, you don't have to have the government defending its people or taking, you know, attacking other nations or whatever. You have peoples within other nations, so that's a little different there. Plus, in the New Testament, you're talking maybe a period of 100 years. And so how much history are you going to have in 100 years as compared to the Old Testament? Or, as I said before, you're at least 2,000 years. So any nation over 2,000 years, you're going to see a wider spread of many things happening, including military activity.
So when you get the question of, but I like the God of the New Testament a lot better. He seems peaceful and loving, and I'm not so sure about the God of the Old Testament. How do you help write that comment?
Well, I say, don't forget that you have the book of Revelation in the New Testament, where we go to the end of our age. And it's a little different because it's apocalyptic prophecy, so it's, you know, the visions and it's weird and all that, so it's harder to understand. But there we have the same God who sent Jesus, who's so loving and wants us to live at peace and all that, who is very angry with sin at the end. And so he pours out waves of judgment on a sinful world, and many people die in their martyrs' crowns. And so I say, don't forget to factor into the God of the New Testament, that God in Revelation who is angry with sin and must judge it there. And we see over the Old Testament a longer history, so we see God judging sin in the Old Testament, in other nations and in Israel. So he used armies to do that.
So one of the things I love about reading your book is you give so much background so that it's a lot easier to then understand what I'm reading in Scripture. Why is it important for us to go a little bit deeper and understand the background of what's happening at the time that the Bible was written?
Sure. I don't think you need to understand the world of the Bible to understand much of the message of it, but I think it's very often very helpful to understand the background, because God didn't just drop a book out of the sky with theological truth. He dealt with real people in real situations in particular places and times. So the more we know about that world or those worlds, the better we can understand what he's saying and doing in those times. So in the Old Testament, that's more important than in the New Testament, because it's so much farther removed from us in distance and time and culture and language.
It seems in the New Testament that we're talking more about, now that we know what we know, how do we do what we know that we're supposed to do? That God laid everything out, and then he's showing us how to actually live that out. Is that a fair assessment?
Sure. Plus, it's the New Testament deals with the New Covenant, involving and after the ministry of Jesus also. So that's our covenant, where, again, we're not a nation, but we are Christians in other nations. So it's more our covenant and our theology and the things that we're supposed to do. So it's a better match for us than dealing with the Israelites in their nation in a very different time and even under a different religious system to some degree.
But there seems like there's so much of the Old Testament weaved into the New Testament that if we don't know at least a little bit about what's going on in the Old Testament, then some of the things in the New Testament don't make as much sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, one is the base and the other builds on it. And we are kind of at the top of the pyramid with all of this revelation. And so the New Testament is much closer to us historically, theologically, even in concept and in language and in thought. So it's more helpful to us. But the New Testament is based on the Old Testament. And so it is helpful. It's not always, again, not always necessary, but it's helpful to know where that comes from.
We're talking with Dr. Boyd Sievers today. He is a professor at University of Northwestern St. Paul and has written a book called Warfare in the Old Testament, The Organization, Weapons, and Tactics of the Ancient Near Eastern Armies. So we're going to talk a little bit more about those armies coming up. If you have a question about the Old Testament that you've been wondering about, or maybe something specifically about warfare, how it was that these armies fought, what kind of weapons they used, well, give us a call. We'd love to get your question on the air. We also have a handful of Boyd's books to give away, and we'd love to get one of those in your hands as well. So you can call us at 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Or you can go to myfaithradio.com, click on Connecting Faith, and you can enter your question in there, and we'll try to get that on the air as well. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're talking with Dr. Boyd Sievers, a professor at University of Northwestern St. Paul, an expert in Old Testament warfare. And we are chatting a little bit about his book, Warfare in the Old Testament. And Dr. Sievers, tell me what are the battles that are significant that we hear about in the Old Testament? And why do you think that those particular battles are those that were included?
When you say that, I think of three, not just battles, but periods of military activity. I would say Moses and the Israelites escaping Egypt, and then the Egyptian army failing at the Red Sea or the Reed Sea. So Israel, one, defeated the Egyptian army to give the nation freedom. Then the next one I think of is Joshua and the Israelites when they conquered Canaan, or they conquered the heart of Canaan. So that's when the nation secured its homeland. And then the third period that I think of is David, when he led Israel to dominance in the ancient Near East and took them from a weak kingdom to an empire, to where they were a kingdom ruling other kingdoms. So those are three significant periods in Israelite history as a nation: freedom, homeland, and then dominance. And all of those were done with warfare, connecting to what we said earlier, that there was just a lot of that going on, and that's what happens in national history. And so God was very much involved in the military activity at those times.
So let's look at the Moses and getting away from Egypt. You write a little bit about Pharaoh. Who is Pharaoh, and why is that significant to know when we're talking about warfare?
Sure. Well, he was, of course, the king of Egypt, and the king of ancient Near Eastern kingdoms had very important job functions. Any leader of any nation does our president, of course, who's in town now. And one of those jobs is to be the commander in chief. But for ancient Near Eastern kings, the military part of their job was even more important. They weren't just a commander in chief who made decisions, though they did that, but they were also commander in fact very often, where they often physically led the military into battle. We see David doing that. We see Saul doing that. If you look very carefully at the records of Egypt, you see the Pharaoh very often doing that. And if you scour their records very carefully, as I had to do for this book, you can see that the pharaohs, as they were growing as princes, had military training. So they were skilled, and they were trained in military arts, how to drive a chariot, how to shoot a composite bow. And some of them were very, very fine warriors, quite clearly, and very capable leaders. So the Pharaoh of Egypt was this military leader, and in that culture in particular, he was the intermediary between his nation and God, and he was closer to God than they were. And we think of a big gap between humans and gods, while in the ancient world it was more of a series of steps. And so you had greater people who were closer to the lesser gods, and the Pharaoh was very, very close to that jump into divinity, and at death then he became an eternal god as well. So if the Israelites could defeat Pharaoh and his army, they were defeating a god in the military that he led.
So what role does religion play in a lot of the wars that happened in the Old Testament?
Well, religion was an inescapable part of life in the ancient world for everybody back there, as far as I can tell, and that would necessarily include the military. All these people had their god or their gods. Israel was unique in that it had just one. Everybody else had several or many. And their gods, they understood their gods were involved in their warfare. Their gods told them to go to battle, to do this, to conquer this people, maybe specifically told them how to carry out a particular battle. So their gods were leading them to do that. So if my nation went against your nation, it was not just my army against your army or our army against your army. It was our army with our god or gods against your army and your gods. So it was a contest of armies and a contest of gods.
So in Joshua, we read that Israel's enemies were actually quite intimidated by this god of the Israelites, because he could part great waters and rivers, defeat the military of Egypt, and greatest in the part of the world at that time. So why is it important to understand that as we read those accounts of Joshua?
Well, it's more part of their world. What was their worldview? How did they see that the world operated? And if everybody had their gods, then how should they live life? How should they deal with the world? And if we're going to go against a people who have greater gods than us, then we're in trouble. So then how do we go about that? And by the time the Israelites got to Canaan, the Canaanites had heard about what the Israelite God had done for them, including defeating the military of Egypt. And something I think that we lose perspective on as modern Christians is how superior the Egyptian military was. They had the best military during that time period. If you know Egyptian history, is the time of the New Kingdom or the Late Bronze Age, if you want to talk archaeology. The Egyptians had clearly the best military, and for a bunch of slaves to defeat them, that was impossible. It was incomprehensible, and for it to have happened clearly meant that the God of the slaves had acted. And if he had acted and defeated the Egyptians, what hope did the Canaanites have? So, again, that's another illustration of the more you understand about that world, the more you understand what is happening and what these people are saying and what God is teaching through the story. So I find it helpful to know that world.
So when we read those sort of accounts in the Old Testament, then we are also trying to find the lesson in what was God trying to teach those people at that time through this war, correct?
Absolutely, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what is happening to them and what is God doing and teaching? What were they to have learned from that? They would know easily and intuitively what they were supposed to get from that, whereas we, as very distant observers or readers, have a much more difficult time with it.
And yet you can still draw application to that, because I would often say, how can they not remember what God just did for them? I mean, he parted a sea, for goodness sake. And yet I seem to do that as well.
Right. And it had been, what, a generation, you know,
right,
passed from the parting of the sea till they got to the swollen Jordan River. And after a generation, can you not forget that or forget the impact of it?
Right.
Or if they weren't alive at the Red Sea, they just heard it from their parents.
And they thought their parents might be exaggerating, like how far you had to walk to school or how big the snowdrifts were.
That's right. And if it doesn't happen to me in my lifetime, how real is it? And so they had to relearn that. And so God took that next generation through a number of the same things that the previous generation had as well.
So when an army would defeat another, what would happen then? What was the purpose of trying to defeat another army or another land?
I think one way you can say it is competition for resources. There are people over there. There are fewer natural resources in that part of the world than there are here. Again, I think that's something that as Americans we kind of don't get, because we live in such a lush country, huge, lush, very fertile, very well protected. So we kind of don't understand what it's like to be in an area where there are fewer resources and less competition for them. But in the Middle East, that was the case. That is the case. So we don't have enough land. We don't have enough good land. We need more. Let's take it from these people who live next to us, who are weaker than we are. So let's go take their stuff. And it was quite common for one people or one nation to go take over land from another nation. If you watch for that, you see it over and over and over again in the Old Testament.
And water. Water.
Yes.
Huge commodity as well.
Yes. So what was and still is over there.
What happened to the people then? If they took the land, where did the people go?
Well, they could die or become slaves or leave. And a lot of those, all of those things happened. And it just depended on the situation and how the war played out, how the battle played out. Sometimes when the Israel took Jericho, they made a special point, this whole city is an offering to the God. We will destroy it all as a way of presenting something to God. I think that's weird. You know, if I want to give something to God, I don't take my car and burn it as an offering to God. I may sell it and give the check, you know, to the church or something. But in that world, they made sacrifices. They destroyed things to send them up to God. So you could do that even with the whole city, with the whole population of a city. So the Israelites did that at Jericho. In other places, they drove the people out. They drove them away so they could take over their cities and their land. And in other cases, they did not do that or could not do that. And so once you defeated them, then those people have to be your servants, and they have to do your hard manual labor that you don't want to do, like cutting wood or bringing water.
Mm. So what would be the key to the success of the Israelites? Would they, what caused them to succeed and what caused them to fail as far as what's written in Scripture?
Sure. So the Scripture is looking primarily at theological realities. What has God told us to do, and are we obedient to that? and that there's an overlay of that over their military activities. So the Bible will talk about that. And then it also talks about the physical realities of how they actually carried out warfare, how their armies actually fought. And so you have both of those things, but the emphasis is on the former. Is God behind this? Is God telling us to do this? Are we being obedient to him in the instructions for this military activity? Or more broadly, are we being an obedient covenantal people to the rules he gave us in our national Mosaic covenant? And if so, he will bless us. And part of that blessing included military success.
So it seems like I'm reading over and over again kind of the same lesson as I read of all these different accounts of wars or experiences of the Israelites, that they are either successful and faithful, or that they fail and then they are very unsuccessful and they have to go through that period again. Is that kind of a theme that runs through the entire Old Testament?
Absolutely. You know, do we know God and walk with him, and are we obedient to him? That really kind of sums up all of Scripture and what we're supposed to do as the people of God. Know him and walk with him. And for them, as a people in a nation with a particular covenant with God, they were to be obedient and had a clear set of laws to do that. And so that played out through their military.
So we read a lot about, or you wrote a lot about, the different kinds of people groups that the Israelites would come up against. We've talked a little bit about the Egyptians and how they were just a superior army to the Israelites. What are some of the other people groups that the Israelites would come up against?
Well, the Egyptians were superior at the time of the Exodus, but then they were losing power. They were losing steam. At about 1200 BC, there was a massive change in the ancient world, and nations collapsed, empires shrank, and the Egyptians were one of those. So they lost their power and their ability to control other areas. And that's right as the Israelites are settling into Canaan. I mean, did they get there in the 1200s or 1400s? Either way, they're getting there and they're settling in when the Egyptians have lost their power. So in that time of transition, who will take over? Will it be the Israelites who are settling there, the Egyptians, the Moabites? Will it be these Philistines who have come from the west, from the area of the Aegean or Greece? And those people come from the west with a militaristic perspective, with very good military ability. So they are the ones who are superior until the time of David. Through the period of the judges and into the Israelite monarchy, the Philistines are the best military, the top dog,
they're,
if you will.
They're unstoppable.
For a while they were, yes.
Hmm. Well, when we come back, I'm going to ask a few more questions about, of course, you've all heard the story of David and Goliath. We're going to talk a little bit about that and then maybe get into some of the weaponry that was used at that time and how what we are to learn from that as well. We've had a couple of calls. I know you're getting some books in your hands, but we still have a few more. If you're interested in getting a book, a copy of Dr. Seaver's book, Warfare in the Old Testament, give us a call at 1-877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484. You can go online, go to myfaithradio.com, and you can enter a question or comment there, and we'll try to get this in your hands as well. So we will be right back talking about warfare in the Old Testament coming up on Connecting Faith. Connecting Faith, thanks so much for joining us today. Ryan, that is some very militarily pomp. I don't know. I don't
majestic.
Even know. Pomp and circumstance. Majestic.
I composed that music myself. No.
That is very good. It speaks to warfare, and you can just see the armies marching. We are talking today with Dr. Boyd Seavers. He is a professor at University of Northwestern St. Paul, and also an expert on warfare and Old Testament. I myself have had him as a professor, as have you, Ryan.
I have.
I know.
Yes.
So we are very blessed to have him here today just to enlighten us on just some of the things that are in the Old Testament where you kind of wonder, why would God have put that in there? It seems like he seems angry and like he's talking about war and there's a lot of blood. And sometimes you wonder, why is all of that in there? So let me just start with that question, Dr. Sievers. Why is all of that in there?
Because his people went through all of that. They were slaves in Egypt. We can start there. And to escape from that, the powerful Egyptian military had to be defeated. And so a lot of people died in that battle. And then when they moved to the promised land, they had to take the land that had been promised to them for literally centuries. But to take it, they had to do so militarily. So God had to help them with their military skills.
So we were chatting a little bit about that time that the Israelites were in the desert, and it was during that time that they became a stronger military force, correct?
They became a bunch of slaves getting out of captivity have only certain skills, and military would probably not be very high on those lists, so they had to learn those capabilities as they were moving toward Canaan.
And then they were able to eventually take Canaan, of course, but we were talking a little bit about the Philistines, and they were a nasty group, correct?
Yes, they were quite a militaristic group, very successful, very powerful, nearly defeated the Egyptians when they came to that region, lost that battle, and then they had to settle where they did. So, but they were very, very skilled militarily.
And that's where we're introduced to David, and everyone, of course, has heard the story of David and Goliath. And one of the things, one of the parts of your book I found incredibly interesting was just reading about all of the tools and all of the weapons that were used, and the sling was actually one of them. The way that we're told this story when we are children in Sunday school, it sounds like it's just some kid who has a slingshot. But in fact, a sling was a weapon that was commonly used in warfare, correct?
It was and continued to be and still is. In fact, if you watch sometimes the rioting in the Middle East, for example, you'll see kids out there with slings because they're easy to make. You just need two strings, if you will, two cords on the side and then some kind of pouch in the middle, and then a rock. And rocks are harder to come by around here than they are over in the Middle East. Over in the Middle East, they're just everywhere, and so you have an unlimited supply of ammunition. So they're quite easy to make. You'll make them out of some kind of cloth. If you are a shepherd, for example, all you'd have to do would be to snip some wool off of one of the sheep that you are leading around. You wind it into to string, and then you weave that into a simple sling. So David probably took David an afternoon, I would guess, to make one of those, and then he would have unlimited ammunition to practice and almost countless hours to practice that skill as well. So it'd be something that he would use as a shepherd. He might use it to scare away animals. He might use it to direct his sheep. If you send a rock to their right, then they will move to the left. So it'd be something that was a natural part of that world.
So he was likely very skilled in using the sling. And so when you think about that and then you listen to the story again, now it doesn't seem quite as far-fetched as when you hear it when you're a child.
Oh, he was a boy, and that would have been one of his toys. It would have been also a tool that he used for his job. And you can get very, very skilled at using those things. I was reading a story from, I think, the 1930s about a traveler in the Arabian desert, and he's with a tribe of nomads, and the kids in the tribe were practicing with their sling, and they could hit a tent peg from 15 paces. So 15 yards away, they could regularly hit something as small as a tent peg. Now, that's not as good as slinging at a hare and not missing, which I think is probably an exaggeration, but you can be very, very accurate with a sling.
What are some of the other weapons that are notable for the Israelites using during that time frame?
Well, the sling is one of it falls into the category of long-range weapons. If you have weaponry to attack, you can do so from a distance, far distance, medium distance, or close range. And a sling would be a long-range weapon. So you can sling with accuracy. Well, it depends how you measure all that, but 100 yards, 400 yards, you can strike. Another long-range weapon would be the bow, where you could, again, shoot an arrow, depending on the quality of your materials. Again, 100 yards, 400 yards. If you're shooting into a mass of troops, a good bow from 400 yards, you can probably hit somebody in that mass of troops. So you have long-range weapons like the bow and the sling. A medium-range weapon would be a javelin, like a smaller spear, a stick with a pointed end that you could throw a certain distance. And then close-range weapons would be things like swords, the most common weapon referred to in the Bible, or spears, which may have actually been the most common weapon, where it's you have a stick with a bigger point on the end, and you try to stab the person directly opposite from you.
That's when it seems like it's getting very bloody and gory as you're reading these accounts.
Yes, and very personal.
And right, because you have to get very close.
And you are looking the guy in the eye, and you know, if you are mean and good at trash talking and you have a reputation and an attitude like Goliath did or whatever, you know, that physical intimidation from 4 feet away would be a major part of that. So it'd take a tremendous amount of skill and courage and probably creativity to manage all of that. And that's something that I don't think we have so much in warfare today.
Well, you don't generally need to get that close to a person.
No. In fact, as I was writing this book, one of my people that helped me was an American Marine sergeant who says, I can't imagine being close enough where you can see the eyes of the guy that you're shooting at. So now we don't do that. Back then, that was the norm.
Mm. So some people would ask, doesn't God want us to avoid warfare?
Sure. Ultimately, we will. Ultimately, God will remake this world. And when the Messiah rules, when God redoes all of the world and humanity, then we will beat our swords into plowshares. Then the lamb will lay down with the lion. Eventually, we will get away from that. Until that happens, we're sinful, we're fallen, we're selfish, we're going to be competing with other people, and there's going to be conflict, and nations conflict with military. So we should be at peace as much as possible, live at peace with all men. But governments of nations have responsibilities to protect their people, and sometimes that includes warfare.
So it doesn't seem like when we think about our armies today and the training and the organization that goes into our military, obviously it was much more primitive at that time. How did the Israelites or other people groups organize their military? I mean, how did they train?
That depended on the size and ability and sophistication of a nation. If you were a small nation and you just had part-time soldiers like farmers or merchants or whatever, and you know, like the militiamen, the Minutemen in early American history, you're farmers and you grab your squirrel rifle or whatever, you know, and you go fight, then you'd be less sophisticated. And in antiquity, these would be farmers or tradesmen who would take their farming implements or a sharp stick or their sling with their rocks or something, and they would go try to fight. Whereas a larger, more sophisticated, more capable, wealthier nation could then make weapons, make iron, or first bronze and then iron weapons, and cover their people with armor protection or give them swords or make them metal helmets so that they would have better capabilities. They could make or buy chariots and buy the horses and train them all. And the stronger nations would be have better militaries, quite simply.
So let's talk a little bit about armor, because there are references. I wrote down Ephesians 6 as one of them about putting on the armor of God. Those become a lot more real when you understand what kind of armor the people, the Israelites, had back in the time when they were fighting so much. All of a sudden, that armor becomes much more important and a great understanding of how God is relating that message to us in the New Testament. Correct?
Sure, sure. That passage in Ephesians was written by Paul at the time of the Roman world and the Roman armies, which, of course, were spectacular and very successful. And just people broadly would know what the Roman military was like. They would probably have been used to seeing Roman soldiers, and so they would know the gear that the Roman soldier had. And so he's making connections of spiritual truths to his world of his day, to the Roman military that was there. And so he talks about spiritual realities and uses the figure of a soldier. And if you look at that carefully, I find it quite interesting that most of that is defensive, that you have the helmet, you have the breastplate, you have the belt, which which you hang things on and kind of holds things together. So you have the feet, the shoes for moving things around, and you have the shield, of course. And all of that is to protect you from enemy attack. There's only one thing that's offensive, and that's the sword of the Spirit. And so I wonder if there's a lesson in even that, that as believers, there are spiritual realities out there, and as good people of God, we need to deal well with them. But should we go on the offensive and attack spiritually, or primarily should we be trying to hold our ground and defend ourselves and then sometimes go on the offensive? I wonder about that.
Huh. That is a really good question. Well, what do you think the answer to that question is?
Well, when I'm teaching through classes in the Bible and we talk about...
Then you tell us that we have to come up with the answer by ourselves.
I want you to wrestle with it.
Yes,
yes. And come up with what you think is the best answer. I find that the passages in the Bible that have to do with spiritual warfare, like that passage in Ephesians or in Daniel chapter, what is it, 11, I think, angels, good and bad angels fighting and all that, there are a few... frustratingly brief passages about those realities. And we have power in those realms, but taking on those realms, as far as I can see in the Bible, isn't a major part of what we are to be about as Christians. So should we be aware of that? Yes. Should we be protected in those areas? I think so. But should we go after those kinds of things? I'm not so sure. Just practically, I know of certain people who have special sensitivity and I think a special calling and ability to do those kinds of things. And so I may go with them and pray with them, and pray for them. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to lead that charge because that's not a calling or a gifting that I think I have. And since it's not a major teaching in Scripture, then I think I'm going to be more cautious about it.
Well, even as if I'm thinking about the different battles that took place in the Old Testament, some were commanded, the Israelites were commanded by God to go and fight, and others, he was not commanding them to go fight, but he was giving them strength and power to withstand.
Right.
And it seems like that's exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, to a large degree. Although, again, in the Old Testament, you're talking about a nation, and how a nation deals with other nations is different than how an individual deals with life. We are to do certain things, but we don't have the responsibilities. We don't have some of the responsibilities that a whole nation would.
Good point. We're talking today with Dr. Boyd Sievers. He's a professor of Old Testament studies at the University of Northwestern St. Paul. He is an expert on ancient warfare and has also gone to Israel several times to participate in archaeological excavations, also lived in Israel for 8 years. So we're getting the benefit of all of that knowledge and wisdom as we're talking about warfare in the Old Testament. In fact, he's written a book on the subject, Warfare in the Old Testament, The Organization, Weapons, and Tactics of the Ancient Near Eastern Armies. If this is a subject you have some interest in, we have just a couple of copies left, and we're going to save those for people who have a question for Dr. Sievers about warfare in the Old Testament, or really anything on the Old Testament. I'm sure he'd be happy to answer. So give us a call at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484, and we will be back on Connecting Faith.
Free for the asking. Again, myfaithradio.com.
Welcome back to Connecting Faith. Thanks so much for joining us today. We're talking Old Testament today, one of my favorite subjects. Always fun to talk with my friend, Dr. Boyd Sievers, about the military in the Old Testament and warfare and why God included that in the Old Testament. Was it to teach us? Was it to teach the Israelites and teach us through them? It seems to be a common thread. We have some people who've called in with some questions, so I am going to ask you one of them. Dr. Sievers, did the military success for the Israelites always represent that they were on the right path and the path that God wanted?
That's a really good question. I would assume that most of the time that was the case, but not necessarily all of the time. As I'm thinking through that, I immediately go to the expansion of the Northern Kingdom not too far before they collapsed and were conquered. And there we don't see that their success was based on their righteousness. I think they just had a really good military and they were able to expand there for a while. And then the Assyrians came in and crushed them. So that didn't last very long. So I largely yes, but not necessarily all the time.
Here's a question I've had before. I'm sure you've had this before. The questioner or the caller says, the Old Testament law says thou shalt not kill. So was that sidestepped or modified in times of war?
That's a question I hear a fair bit. And I always start by saying the Old Testament law doesn't say don't kill, but don't murder. The last time I looked at a cross-section of translations of the Old Testament, it was only the King James that still used the word kill. Everybody else uses murder, and that's more accurate. Hebrew has a number of words for killing and murder, and they overlap to some degree. But God says, do not commit murder, which is different than killing. And how is it different? Well, killing is taking life. And you can take life of an animal. You can take life of a number of things. You can even take human life. And if you take it with justification, then that's killing. In the Old Testament, I see that God says you can kill a person in self-defense. That's okay. You can kill in warfare. That's okay, too. And you can kill in capital punishment. God said there are certain things that are so egregious, so grievous, that if somebody does these, you need to take their life. So capital punishment is killing, justified killing as well, in the Old Testament at least. Now, it says don't commit murder, which would be taking life without justification. If you have something and I want it and I kill you to take it, then that's murder. Or if I get angry with you, maybe it's manslaughter or whatever. But there's a difference between killing and murder, and the command is do not commit murder. Don't take human life. That's not justified.
Okay. I hope that answered your question for you. So you were talking a little bit about the Assyrians, and they were known for being particularly brutal. Were their practices really that different? Well, first of all, why don't you tell us what some of those practices are that are known for being particularly brutal, and then tell us whether or not those are that different from what the Israelites or Egyptians did.
Sure. So the Assyrians were a people that dominated the ancient Near East for 250 years, depending on how you measure that. They controlled Israel. They conquered the northern kingdom. They almost conquered Jerusalem and Judah as well. They dominated the map for a very long period of time because they were highly militaristic, and their society was built on their military. They became great and kept their greatness because they were so good. And part of the way they did it was being horribly brutal. And part of that was that they would use that as a weapon. They would go into an area, I want to conquer this area, I'll pick out the weakest of these cities, and I won't just conquer it, I'll go in and I'll kill everybody and rape the women and skin the leaders, maybe even alive, and the news would spread, and I will help spread the news. And if I do that, these horrible acts in one of the weakest of these cities, then the other cities will probably give in as well.
So it was almost intimidation.
Oh, it was clearly intimidation, which is a very good factor in warfare. I mean, even the American military does that. Before we invaded Baghdad, we intimidated them. We're going to, you know, do shock and awe. We tried to do it nicely, but we did it through intimidation. I think probably all successful militaries do that. And the Assyrians had no qualms about it, and they did it and were very good at it. And they would advertise it, and they would make pictures of it, and they would decorate their palaces and their temples with scenes of conquest and military atrocities. It makes them fascinating to study. And you ask, were they worse than other people? I think maybe in a matter of degree, but not in kind. I think all militaries commit atrocities. Even we as Americans deal with that. We go in somewhere and you can't control everybody, and it's so tough and stressful and all that, and people get out of hand. Even when you try to be nice, it's almost impossible to do that. So everybody did it, but not everybody made it a regular practice and emphasized it and made it almost an art form the way the Assyrians did, and then advertised it and preserved it. And so it makes for fascinating stuff to study, but I wouldn't want my daughter to date an Assyrian, you know, if you will.
Well, and you say there's a lot of scenes and pictures that are available. Tell me a little bit about what you found and what you'd studied in order to understand this more. How can people see these things?
Well, they're, like I said, Egyptian palaces and temples had these scenes, and so people photographed them, and you can find photographs in books. You can find, like there was one book that I studied for this a book that I wrote that just cataloged all the military scenes and weaponry through all of these Egyptian scenes. That's taking parts of it. I have a whole bunch of the drawings from those Egyptian scenes in my book that I had my lead artist, who's actually my son, Josh, make line drawings of these things. And so much of the best imagery we have of Old Testament warfare comes from the Assyrians. And in fact, the very best imagery of Israelites fighting comes from the Assyrians, because they made a whole, decorated a whole room with scenes of the Judean city of Lachish falling in 701 BC. And so we see Judeans there fighting and trying to defend their city.
Do you think that those might be a little bit biased, though? Because, well, the Assyrians probably, well, we know that they won the battle, but would they have made it worse, made it seem worse in their propaganda?
The victors always get to write the history, and the victors get to portray the history. And so that's an excellent question. It's a question you always have to ask of artwork, like you say, or of written work as well. This person says this happened. What were their motives as well, and does that seem to match up with reality? It's an excellent question. It's one that we can't always answer, but you can come up with a pretty good idea that, yeah, they really did, you know, do that terrible stuff.
So a lot of these practices, they do seem brutal. I mean, reading about putting heads on the end of a spear or hanging people on a spear, skinning people alive, crushing babies against rocks. There's so many things that kind of make you gasp as you're reading through the Old Testament. And some of these practices just seem so brutal. So why would God, who's supposed to be all about bringing peace, condone these things by his people?
Well, he condones their warfare. He gave them rules about warfare. He was nicer in the rules that he gave than the other nations were around them. We find some of that stuff very difficult, but in that world, those were the kinds of things that people did. So God is working with his people who are dealing in that world. He gave them rules of warfare, and again, they were nicer than their neighbors, or they were supposed to be nicer than their neighbors. So did God condone those things? Not all of them, not the skinning alive. He wouldn't even condone cutting down fruit trees around a city. When you go to attack a city, he said, leave the fruit trees, because somebody's going to need the food afterward. Whereas the Pharaoh of Egypt or the king of Assyria will boast about cutting down the fruit trees because he really wanted to punish them. The God of Israel was more humane, was nicer about it, and did things that are several steps more to mean than what we would like. But in that world at that time, it was kinder, it was more controlled.
So if someone were to say to you, I don't know, I really have a hard time with the Old Testament, what would be your encouragement to them as to why it is just rich to understand who God is by studying the God of the Old Testament?
Because the God of the Old Testament is our God as well. And God deals with us in our lives, in our real world, with things that we go through. And the Old Testament is a record of him doing that with the Israelites over a very long period of time. So when I read it, some of the stuff I don't understand or some of the things I don't like, on the other hand, it's very real. Their world was harsh. They didn't live as long as we did. They had a harder life, but God was with them and wanted to bless them and wanted them to be responsive and obedient and walk with him. And it's very real. Their challenges were real, just like my challenges are real. My challenges are usually different than theirs in some ways. In other ways, they're just the same. The challenge is to walk with God and treat other people well. Mm. You know, that's the whole deal. That may look very different in my world than it did in theirs, but I like reading the Old Testament and studying the Old Testament because it's real, and God is dealing with real people in real situations, and they had to connect their faith to their world just like we do.
I remember reading the story of Joseph, and we had to underline or highlight every time it said, but God was with Joseph. And so you would read these terrible accounts of how in the world did he get in that situation now? And yet it would always end it with, but God was with Joseph. And right. That seems to be an underlying theme of what he's trying to show us in much of the Old Testament.
Sure. I may not be a prisoner or a slave for 13 years, but God is with me when I go through hard times, like he did with Joseph.
Yep. And like he still does today. Well, we've been having a fabulous conversation with Dr. Boyd Sievers. He's professor of Old Testament Studies at University of Northwestern St. Paul. If you'd like to get a copy of his book, Warfare in the Old Testament, you can go online, right, where books are sold?
Sure, like Amazon.com or any of those places.
Absolutely, or head to our website and we can connect you up with that as well. Thanks so much for joining us on Connecting Faith.